Good morning. This is class two of the Exploration of Pilgrimage. I'm Casey. This week we're going to be talking about pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Sorry to have to do that again for the recording. So what did you talk about last week in the Exploration of Pilgrimage last week? Those of you who are here.
We talked about
Scotland.
Yeah, they go to Scotland.
Okay.
And kind of the path that they took last year and what they do each.
Every other year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Awesome. And have any of you been to any of those places before? Yes? Great. So we're going to build on this. We're kind of having an arc because we're exploring in 3 weeks three different pilgrimages that Transfiguration folks have been on. But I'm trying to also, the goal of the series is also to stir up within us an understanding of what pilgrimage is, whether we go on these specific journeys or some other journey, some other sacred act of pilgrimage elsewhere in the world. So last week was Scotland. The youth will once again go this year, this summer. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about travel to Palestine, to the Holy Land, and to the sacred places in Jerusalem and around. And next week, we'll talk a little bit about South Africa, which is a pilgrimage some of us are going to be able to go on next June. Not this coming June, but next June. And there are still some openings for that. So let's start from the beginning. Before I get too deeply into this, talking about Jerusalem or the Holy Land, what is a pilgrimage? What is it? How is it different than other kinds of travel?
You walk a lot.
You walk a lot? Well, say more. You walk a lot.
That's at least the bus. It's supposed to be more about walking. So it's like, even though they do take, obviously, airplanes to get there and the ferry and et cetera, those are just, you have to kind of get to where you're going. But he emphasized how during the days they would actually just try not to use public transportation and just
be on foot. Why do you think on pilgrimage being on foot is important?
Tracing footsteps.
How? Say more.
That somebody's already taken and you're following that same path.
Yeah, both literal and metaphorical. Yeah. What by being on foot, what inherently happens to your itinerary? It slows way down. And that's one of the main distinctions between a pilgrimage and, say, a tour, a vacation tour trip, is the pace is intended to slow way down so you don't feel frenetic, so that you don't feel like you're ricocheting from site to site, so that you can just take pictures to take home with you. A pilgrimage is intended to be an immersion in the holiness of a place, and therefore by being on foot, you just can't bebop around in the same way, and you have to be more thoughtful and intentional. Unless you have loads and loads and loads of energy and can just run from place to place, you're going to have to be more careful and intentional about what it is that you're doing, and you're slowing way down. I wonder what else sort of distinguishes pilgrimage from other kinds of travel. Say more, the spiritual nature, but what does that mean?
Trying to get back in touch with your roots, with your Heavenly Father.
The purpose being connection with God, with your Heavenly Father. That unlike, a vacation, which is about personal restoration or refreshment, which pilgrimage can encompass, but that's not the point. That's a side effect if it comes at all. Sometimes, actually, pilgrimage can be quite exhausting. But the point is to go and encounter God. The point is a spiritual journey. Tell me about a little bit about what the distinction between a pilgrimage and, say, a mission trip might be. If that's even ever occurred to you that there might be a distinction between a pilgrimage and a mission trip. Yeah. Yes.
Service to others.
Yeah. So a mission trip is is more expressly about going in order to serve and minister to the people in the place where you're traveling, whether that's local or regional or international, that you are going with a, theoretically, with a mission to serve and bless others in a compassionate way. Pilgrimage, once again, can encompass that. When you go on pilgrimage, you can wind up doing some of that. But there can be, in its shadow side of mission trips, the shadow side of mission trips is that I have something to take and to give to these people where I'm going. I, the wealthy American, have the resources, money, knowledge, skills, etc., that these poor people in Honduras or Haiti or Tanzania don't have, and I'm going to give it to them. And that's the shadow side. I'm not saying that that has to be what mission trips, or that the mission trips that Transfiguration has gone on have necessarily been like that. But that is a dangerous undercurrent possibility. Pilgrimage tries to deconstruct that by saying, you're not carrying anything with you. You are on a holy journey completely and utterly, and actually your destination has something to bless you, is going to bless you. God is there not only in the journey, but also wherever you're going, and you are going to be the recipient of the grace and blessing of the people and the sites where you're traveling. So it's quite the opposite. If we're going to take it and sort of talk about it in a transactional way, a mission trip is you are bringing some good or service. In a pilgrimage, you're going and you're empty, and they're blessing you in return. And so it flips it on its head. Once again, pilgrimage can have a little bit of both. I've been on pilgrimage to South Dakota, and part of it was to explore Native American Christianity and the way that Native American culture has embraced the Christian faith and created this beautiful expression that is quite distinct and unique in some of the beautiful places in South Dakota. And while we were there, we went on the reservation, and the reservations in South Dakota are some of the poorest places in our country, quite literally some of the absolute most devastatingly poor. And so we did some work there to try to do something that we thought could be helpful. But we went knowing that we were poor, and that they had riches of love and knowledge and faith to give back to us. So, a pilgrimage is a journey to a place of known holiness where both the act of travel and the destination itself bring you closer to God. It's not a retreat, it's not a vacation, it's not a mission trip, it's something unique because pilgrims travel with a heightened awareness of God's presence and also the knowledge that that they're going to receive, to meet God and receive back. It's recognizing that some places are imbued with a deeper sense of holiness than others. Or at the very least, that we can sense the holiness of God in some places more than others. I don't want to say that some places God is more in some place than other, because that doesn't make any sense theologically speaking, that doesn't make any sense. At the same time, we know when we are setting foot in a place that is palpably soaked in God's presence more than how we felt in other places. That's, in many ways, how we feel when hopefully we set foot in the church. Differentiates it from just down the street. We don't say that God is more here necessarily, but that it has become more innately and in a way we can connect with God more easily in that place. So we journey. The most ancient Christian pilgrimage site, and pilgrimage is not just a Christian activity or a act of spiritual devotion within the Christian faith, but is known within a variety of different religious traditions. We're going to talk clearly about Christian pilgrimage, and the origin, essentially the origin of Christian pilgrimage, is pilgrimage to Jerusalem. It is the place where the earliest Christians, as the gospel was proclaimed and carried out into the distant corners of the Roman Empire and the world, where people first began to gravitate back in order to see the places of the stories that they were being taught. So if you can understand, that early Christianity was an oral tradition, the further you get away from Jerusalem, as Paul and the other apostles are carrying the gospel out, The further out they go, the less people have any knowledge or understanding of Jerusalem or any of the Judean wilderness or Galilee. They can't picture it in their mind's eye. They've never lived there. And so some of them were able to travel back to see and witness that. Today, there is no essentially more elevated or revered pilgrimage site than Jerusalem, though two other locations receive many more pilgrims. Rome and Mexico City receive several factors more pilgrims, but Jerusalem has and always will capture the minds of Christians because of everything that happened there. So a brief history of pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Pilgrimage in the very ancient world was largely non-existent in the first couple of centuries because of Roman persecution. It's not safe to be a Christian necessarily in the first 2 centuries, and thus in the middle of the 2nd century, several active persecutions made claiming your Christian faith dangerous, and so you weren't going to travel from modern-day Turkey or from modern-day Italy or Rome back openly, and so it was quite dangerous, though, ironically, at that time, it would have been the most safe because the Roman Empire was at its height, and the roads were the safest, the travel ways were the safest, the transportation methods were their most robust for many, many, many centuries thereafter. The world would never be safer or more at peace, essentially, than it was at that time. And yet, ironically, it would never be less safe to be a Christian in doing that kind of travel. So it was a sort of perverse kind of irony that confluence happened in that way. And yet some Christians did make their way to Jerusalem. And of course, a tight and quiet Christian presence remained in the Levant, in the area of Palestine, of ancient Israel, and up into what we call Syria. There are many ancient sites all along the coast and through the Judean wilderness and up into Samaria and north of Galilee. Christians have been living in this region and all over into what we know as modern day Iraq. In far west modern day Iraq, ancient Christian communities. And so some of those folks would come. Eventually, of course, Christianity flips from being a persecuted religion to the religion of the empire. And this is a hinge, and it's an important one. Constantine, the name is hopefully familiar, the Roman emperor who converts to Christianity. His mother was Christian. Helena was Christian long before he was. And when Constantine declared his faith, he sent his mother to go to Jerusalem to discover some of the sites that were of holy significance. So it was a journey of discovery, but also a journey of pilgrimage. So Helena travels from Europe, from modern-day Europe, down around and spends several years in and around Syria, Palestine, and the Sinai. And she is the first one to build churches. She builds a couple of enormous churches because of Roman wealth. First at Bethlehem, the modern church of the Nativity in Bethlehem is built upon the foundations of that Helena church. There's a church built on the Mount of Olives, which actually this picture is taken from the Mount of Olives. No longer exists. She built and went out to the Sinai to the place of the burning bush. And she came back and they excavated the place where the true cross, it's believed, tradition venerates that she discovered the true cross buried in the rubble underneath. This is in around 329, so several centuries clearly after Jesus and as the persecution is ending. At this point, pilgrimage to the Holy Land becomes safe for a short window before Rome is sacked. Before the world starts to sort of tilt a little bit and become a less safe place. And so Paul Bradshaw, how many of you sat in on Paul Bradshaw's class on the liturgies of Holy Week during Lent? Paul Bradshaw is, the Reverend Dr. Paul Bradshaw is a parishioner here in retirement, is like the scholar of this era of Christianity, like in the world, which is so crazy. I'm so glad he's not here because I would be nervous. He has studied this, and he is a particular scholar of a person named Egeria. And Egeria was a Roman noble lady who traveled on pilgrimage in the late 4th century, so about 4 or 5 decades after Helena has built all these places, and Rome has started to find all of these sacred sites that have been quietly venerated since the time of Jesus. Very quietly venerated. And they're finding them because there'll be little quiet Christian populations in these places. And they will find the places and they will set up shrines or build larger churches. And so during those several centuries, some of that happens. And the church now that we know is the Church of the Resurrection, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is built. Huge church at that point, enormous church. And by the time of Egeria, Egeria is writing it all down, which is so cool. She was clearly an educated noble lady, Roman noblewoman, because she was able to chronicle her experiences there for 3 years. And she documented everything, and we still have texts from that era, and Paul Bradshaw is a scholar of this. So cool. So we know what some of the buildings look like. We know what the Christians were doing in Jerusalem and around. We know how they worshipped. We know all sorts of cool stuff. All because Egeria travels from what we think was possibly Spain on pilgrimage from Spain. Now think about that. No planes. Travels all the way around and spends 3 years in and around Jerusalem. Amazing thing. Through the next several centuries, we have Byzantine control. So Rome is sacked. The center of the remnant Roman Empire is in Byzantium or Constantinople. And the whole area of Palestine, Syria, that whole area becomes much more what we would understand today to be much more Orthodox in its persuasion, Eastern Orthodox. And Christians remained there, building churches, creating monasteries. The monastery of St. Catherine's in Sinai is the longest continuously inhabited monastery in the world. The place of the burning bush, which you can still go to. It's a little dangerous today. That's a Helena, mid-4th century. So for 1,700 consecutive years, monks have been praying in that place. And continuous Christian inhabitation and presence all throughout the region. The Byzantine Empire, when you go today, you'll see Byzantine ruins, all sorts of stuff. Pilgrims are coming, and they're coming and visiting these places where Christians are there. It's easy for us to think that Christians disappeared, and they didn't. Even when Muhammad and the subsequent inheritors of his leadership spread Islam around all of the southern Mediterranean, up into Spain, and all the way and took all of modern day essentially modern day Turkey and spread far east. Even when the whole region came under Muslim control, there were still pockets of tolerance that allowed certain Christian communities to exist in an unbroken chain. And there were some pilgrims, though very few, who made their way during those centuries. And that's essentially the gap between 700 roughly to the First Crusade, 1099. So for about 400 years, pilgrims are few and far between, but still coming. And we have documents of that. We have some modest, small archaeological remains of that, but they were modest. And it's 1099 that the First Crusade is launched. It is, unfortunately, on my birthday, July 15th, 1099, that Jerusalem is captured. And I say unfortunately because the Crusaders, as you know, were almost indescribably bloodthirsty and violent. And when they laid siege to Jerusalem in 1099, it was not a religious conquest. It was a military conquest. And the chronicles of that day of that siege are quite terrifying as they killed everyone. So. The brutality of that day and the Crusades in general is tremendous. What subsequently happened, though, is for about 200 years, 4 different kingdoms were established, which is so kind of crazy. I didn't learn this until I went there. There were 4 Crusader kingdoms in the region. And so for 200 years, give or take, in some of the 4 kingdoms, Christians began to come again. Churches are being built again or rebuilt. Monasteries are being built and rebuilt. Pilgrims are coming again. Then you go through the long dark ages, and leading up to the Renaissance, becomes much more quiet. The Roman Empire doesn't have the ability to come over, not until much later. There are some Franciscan communities that are able to be tolerated in this region. In the 1500s, we have accounts of some Franciscan monasteries being set up in the region, but it's relatively quiet. It's not until the 18th and 19th century that Europe starts to pay more attention to the region, fighting against the Turkish Empire. And eventually, in the late 1800s, Europe starts to, much like it did elsewhere in the world with the colonial efforts, France, Germany, and Great Britain take turns controlling the region, which is why there is this in Jerusalem, an Anglican Gothic cathedral, which doesn't make any sense, except when you know that Great Britain controlled the region for several decades, and it was during that time that German Lutherans began to have a small presence, modest presence in the region. The French begin to, and a few Roman Catholic French religious orders begin to have a small presence. Actually, Emmaus, which we hear today, one of the traditional sites of Emmaus, is today controlled by a Roman Catholic religious order, French religious order, which is cool, and the English are there as well. St. George's Cathedral and College is the Anglican Cathedral and College in Jerusalem, which is how we, many of us, go on pilgrimage to that place, and they facilitate all of this experience. So I just fast-forwarded like crazy fast through a tremendous amount of history. I want to pause and see if there are any questions, if anything comes to mind for you. Yeah, I'm just going to blow right through all of this. Okay. Today, I just fast-forwarded from the Crusades to today. All right, so today, once again, the region is, I know that this is going to sound crazy to you, relatively safe and stable. And it sounds crazy because everything you see on the news makes it seem like it's like completely volatile and insanely violent. And that's actually an unfortunate misunderstanding of contemporary events. Current socio-political conflict in the region between Palestinians and Israeli Jews, Arab Palestinians, both Muslim and Christian, and Israeli Jews would be a whole different class, series of classes. But that conflict, while it bubbles up and flares up in certain times and places, by and large, pilgrims traveling from around the world, and when you go to the Holy Land, you will meet pilgrims from literally every corner of the world. You will hear every language spoken. It is just amazing, especially Asian countries. It's incredible as Christianity has spread into Asia now. All of those folks want to come and see the Holy Land. So Korean, Chinese, in Indonesia and the Philippines, loads of folks coming, South India, and it's remarkable to be there. All of those pilgrim sites are quite safe. The experience of a foreign pilgrim coming to Palestine, to Israel and Palestine, to Jerusalem, is remarkably safe, and it has never really been easier or safer since those first several centuries until now to go. So you go, and there are, these are pictures from a previous trip of mine, just filled with remarkable opportunities to go and see the places of sacred scripture. It is impossible to describe what it feels like to stand atop the Mount of Olives and to look down at the city. To walk on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and that region in Galilee remains relatively undeveloped today, still largely agricultural. So there's no massive cities built up. It's not It's not populated more. And so you're standing there and you're looking at the panoramic vista, and that is exactly what it looked like at the time of Jesus and before. It is an amazing thing to go to Nablus and to drink from Jacob's well, which is still operational and functional today. You can drop a bucket in Jacob's well and pull it up and drink water out of it. That's crazy. Where Jesus meets the Samaritan woman. It is an amazing thing to, of course, to be in Jerusalem, to stand underneath 2,000-year-old olive trees in Gethsemane, to walk the footsteps, to walk those footsteps. It just stirs your imagination like nothing else. Here is the place of Elizabeth and Mary's greeting. And so it's a place that not only commemorates that, it would have been where Elizabeth and Zechariah lived. We know this. And so there's a well there, much like there are wells all over the place. And so they remember Elizabeth and Mary's encounter in the Magnificat in this particular place. The birthplace of John the Baptist. The stone that tradition says concealed John the Baptist from Herod's violent brutality. The Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, and the small door leading into the Church of the Nativity, the massive throng of pilgrims you can see, the traditional site of the birth of Jesus. That particular place has been venerated for essentially 1,700 years. That place, that specific place. And because Helena would have been painstaking in her choice of the location, she would have spoken to the local indigenous Christians. Bethlehem remains today a largely Christian community, believe it or not. She would have spoken. That place wasn't chosen like they flipped a coin. That's just crazy to think about. A star.
Is that like a window, or what is that?
Theoretically, you could look down to the bedrock, to the ground below, because the church, of course, has paved stones, and so you're looking down through to the bedrock, and you can do that at Calvary as well. You can reach your hand through a hole, much like that, to touch the actual ground below. Does that make sense? The idea is that churches are built atop places, and very rarely do you get to actually touch the ground.
The place where Jesus was born is actually under this.
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, the church sits atop it.
Right on top.
Mm-hmm. So by the 4th century, no homes would... I mean, think about modern America. There are, like, next to no homes from the 1700s, all the more so in an ancient world that rotated through empires controlling them. So that site is the traditional site, but the building sits atop it. And you can reach down and touch the ground beneath. In this place, you can't. In Calvary, you can. Shepherds' caves dot the hillside all around it, where shepherds would have, and until relatively recently in history, brought their flocks in the hillsides around Bethlehem. And as the angels come to greet them, would have likely been staying in caves for safety and protection at night. You can go down into the caves. Remarkable. The Judean wilderness near the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea. Caesarea Philippi, a modern church built atop in Nazareth, the place of Mary's home, of Jesus' childhood. The Basilica of the Annunciation, it's called. Remarkable place. It's built atop, once again, to the earlier point, it's built atop the site, and we have what we think is, or what archaeologists think is, are remains of residence, of the residence that the earliest Christian community was venerating in the background behind him. And actually, this man's name is Bishara, which means Annunciation, so it took his picture in front of the place of the Annunciation. The place of Mary's home, they think, is there. The church is built enormously around it in multi-levels, but the actual ancient site of antiquity is there beneath it. So as pilgrims, you're going to these places, and clearly I'm taking pictures, taking a lot of pictures, because I'm trying to remember it. And as you go to the place as a pilgrim, you read the story once again. And you read the story, and the eyes of your soul, your imagination, are opened to be aware to the story in a new way. To have God come and encounter you in a new way, because you're seeing this place in a new way. And the place where Christians have come and prayed and venerated for all these years. Chapel of the Beatitudes in the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee itself. Look, I mean, that's it. This is the Chapel of the Beatitudes. When he sits down with the 5,000, how easy it is to sit on this beautiful hillside and imagine great crowds gathered around him and him speaking to them. Him coming down to the shore, and there are chapels all along here that commemorate different events in the gospel narrative. And having to go out into a boat because the crowds were so thick that he couldn't stand there, and coming out 20, 30 feet offshore so he could speak to them from his boat. Capernaum is right down here where Peter lived. And you can see the site of Peter's house. And archaeologists have excavated all of Capernaum. And you're just looking around and you're like, they fished. Like, these boats are modern replicas of ancient boats. They would have had no roof then. Modern replicas of ancient boats. And you can see the whole story comes alive in remarkable ways. That's pilgrimage. That's the act of going to a place and encountering God and the stories of sacred scripture in new ways. The loaves and the fishes. An ancient Byzantine mosaic commemorating the site of one of Jesus' great miracles. Clearly not walking on the Sea of Galilee. Signs of modern day conflict and a place of great holiness. But there's the Sea of Galilee. And so this act of pilgrimage, a second century synagogue in Capernaum built atop the first century synagogue, when Jesus goes and begins to speak and teach, he went into the synagogues and the places where Jews met for worship. And this synagogue is built atop the previous synagogue. This synagogue is built atop the place that that is tradition holds that the one of the local Romans who needed Jairus, who needed the healing of his daughter, built for the local community in thanksgiving for Jesus' healing of his daughter. Just remarkable experiences. Modern day conflict again. The modern security barrier, a giant 30-foot tall concrete wall with fortified gun turrets. My wife next to it for scale. Finds a modern day conflict. Just a remarkable thing to go up into these regions and to encounter the ancient stones. But pilgrimage is not just about getting lost in history or in your own imagination. It's also encountering the people of today and meeting the people of today who have maintained this unbroken chain. And so experiencing what they call the living stones as much as the ancient stones is a very important act of pilgrimage wherever you journey, whether it's in Scotland, whether it's in Spain on the Camino, whether it's in Ireland, whether it's in other parts of the world, the local contemporary people are a part of pilgrimage too. You're not just going to take pictures of ancient sites. Smoking the hookah, clearly, it's part of pilgrimage. That was a joke. The Church of the Transfiguration on Mount Tabor. A remarkable place, right outside of Nazareth, on a hillside. This River Jordan and the country of Jordan right across that tiny little muddy river. That is the Jordan River. Ancient monastery, 1600 years old, 15 and 1600 years old. Going down into sites that are, and I've only been talking about Jesus primarily. This, where I'm going into, is a tunnel that is 2700 years old. Built or carved beneath the solid limestone rock beneath Jerusalem to connect one of the springs inside the then walled city of Jerusalem to save the people of the city of Jerusalem when they were under siege from the Assyrians. The Assyrians were coming. They had no water, access to water inside the fortified city. So the king ordered a tunnel carved 50, 60 feet below the surface to connect the spring to the city. And they found that it was long thought to be just biblical lore, myth. And in the 20th century, they found the tunnel and you can walk it. It's like a claustrophobic person's nightmare, like utter, complete, ridiculous nightmare. Without lasers, without GPS, around the year 725 BC, with dead reckoning, they carve 50 feet below the surface a tunnel to connect the water, and you can, and it's still, the spring still is bubbling to this day, and you walk along it and the water is up to your calf and it connects to the Pool of Siloam. And just the most amazing thing. And you're walking through this lived biblical history and connecting far prior to Jesus. And there it connects to the Pool of Siloam. The Tomb of the Patriarchs, Abraham and Sarah, a site venerated clearly by both Jews and Muslims, a site highly contested. You venerate, again, history dating far before Jesus, and come and pray not only as Christians in this place of the patriarchs, but also with Jews and Muslims as well. It's truly one of the rare and precious sites of the that is shared, sometimes not very well. Share is an aspiration, but to share between the Abrahamic faiths. But it's a practicing mosque in part, so the women had to observe traditional Muslim requirements, and then in the synagogue part, right over. Anyway, I know I'm out of time. I wonder, there's Jacob's well. Modern Samaritans. Did you know there are still Samaritans? Samaritans, for me, always were just people who lived in the Bible. Like, they don't actually exist. They're just people that, like, the Jews back in Jesus' time didn't like. But clearly they, like, disappeared or something. No, they're still there, living in that region, in that community. And you go there, and they're still practicing their own religion. They still speak their own language. They still maintain their own traditions and customs. Samaritans date back 2,800 years, to essentially the time of David. It's just an amazing thing, unbroken chain of culture and religious expression. I wonder what questions you have before we end. I want to show you one last thing. There is a piece of graffiti down below in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Far down below, it was found not long ago. Dominus Ivimus. Archaeologists think this dates from the 2nd century. "We shall go" is essentially the translation. "Lord, we shall go" from Psalm 121. It's this rare piece of graffiti really, of pilgrims who had traveled in the 2nd century, late 1st or early 2nd century, to the place of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, and left a mark attesting to their presence. And remember, that's long before it was safe to be a pilgrim there. And they found this ship, this boat. The cross had not yet become a popular symbol of Christianity. There were a number of other symbols that were much more popular. We think, our archaeologists think, this is a symbol of their journey, that they traveled to come there, and an ancient inscription of pilgrims. And now, we also have inscribed in the walls of the Holy Sepulchre crosses, again, graffiti, from Byzantine all the way through Crusader era and up, pilgrims who have traveled to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and left a sign of their travel there. Remarkable things. Whole walls filled with these tiny crosses, which is now clearly illegal. But ancient signs of pilgrims. I wonder if you have any questions before we wrap up.
How long was your pilgrimage?
Melody and I traveled there and spent 3 weeks when we were in seminary. The trip that I took with my previous church was 12, 12 days full in country, 14 total days. The trip that we will take here in 2 weeks from Transfiguration will once again be two weeks. And I would say, if you can manage it, don't go unless you can spend 2 weeks. Because you really, again, you want to slow down. You don't want to feel like you're ricocheting from place to place. You want to be able to sit in these places and just let it just wash over you. And you will see, if you, when you go, you'll see people doing the squeeze it into 6 days. And you just, I lament it for them. That's not a pilgrim experience. So we will pray for all the pilgrims. There are 20 coming from Transfiguration here in a couple weeks. And we will pray for them on the 14th, so in 2 more Sundays' time. The bishop will be here that day, and he will bless us and commission us as pilgrims, which is a pretty cool coincidence that he'll be here that day. And we will leave that afternoon to fly and be gone for a couple of weeks, leading up to Pentecost once again. But you don't have to wait for a Transfiguration trip. You could go.
And it's safe.
It's quite safe. It really is. And when it's not safe, all of the State Department, everyone, everything is very clear when it's not safe. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Yeah.